Hello, Mobilizers. You are listening to Mission Possible. It's season two, and we're looking at new perspective on change for returning citizens. I'm Sheila Murphy, Chief Mobilizer for Mission to Mobilization, focused on changing the way you see our 4.5 million returning citizens, the collateral consequences they face, and the 13th Amendment that is at its root. Thanks for joining the show. Your education is influencing national change. This season's professionals are speaking candidly about the importance of second chances for returning citizens and working their nets to positively impact support for these families. We are also inspired by author and coach Nate Battle. He's teaching us to not only learn how to fight, but win battles for our best life right now. As you know, each guest is phenomenal and has enlightened us in ways we didn't imagine. Today, I'm excited to bring to the show a man of great wisdom, one who believes in the principles of giving and is a husband to a very beautiful wife. On top of that, A. Scott Bolden serves as a white-collar criminal defense attorney, formerly a prosecutor, the D.C. Democratic Party chair, and formerly chair of the National Bar Association of the Political Action Committee. Mr. Bolden is a bold leader, and we're honored to have him on the show. Please help me welcome A. Scott Bolden. Mr. Bolden, good evening.
Hey, good evening, Sheila. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, we want to jump right in. I always like to start and have our audience just to learn a little bit about you. We've got your profile, but please just walk us through kind of a day in the life of A. Scott Bolden. How do you start your day? What kinds of things are you thinking about? And what's challenging you right now?
Well, I've always been a multitasker. I believe in juggling. I don't believe in balance.
Okay.
And the busier I am, the happier I am, the more I'm trying to get done before the good Lord calls me.
Okay.
I think all of us have a mission that He's given us, and you got to get up every day and start thinking about excellence right away.
Mm.
And every day I think about excellence in all parts of my life, whether it's being a husband, whether it's being a father of three grown daughters and a granddaughter, or whether it's my white-collar criminal defense practice, representing people who've been accused of the defense that they deserve under the Constitution. But I'm multifaceted in my various tasking orders, as I say. So I start the morning reviewing email. My wife hates that, but I do, because I'm at a firm that has 1,800 lawyers worldwide, and our office or our firm never sleeps. Somewhere in the world, Reed Smith is up and operating. And so I'm looking at text messages, or rather emails from clients, from internal emails from members like myself or senior management or executive committee members, from my own colleagues. And so I have three jobs basically on a daily basis, more if you count my family, and that's not a job, that's a labor of love. One, I manage 100 lawyers in the D.C. office of Reed Smith, which is a challenge, managing lawyers. Two, I have a robust national litigation practice that takes me to federal and state courtrooms all around the country and sometimes outside of the country.
Mm.
And then thirdly, I have a media obligations. I do a lot of legal and political commentary on all of the cable stations and networks, either based on a case that is in the public eye and being covered, whether it's the impeachment of the president, or whether it's the Democratic nomination process, or the debates and the upcoming caucuses in Iowa, providing commentary, either legal or political. And so every day brings a lot of energy, and every day is a multitude of topics, not just one.
Hmm.
I'm not a lawyer who just sits at his desk and answers the phone and answers emails, and I like it that way. And my message of excellence, my commitment to our communities of color, my commitment to every day. And I'm so very proud that the Lord has blessed me with the energy, the talent, and the desire to be a servant leader and to serve our communities, whether it's through the media, through the legal courtrooms, or through just living a righteous and just and spiritual life.
That's beautiful.
So that's a good picture.
Yeah, it is. It is. It actually kind of reminds me of, I remember in Living Color, when they're like, you only have one job, man. It's like, right, you've got a bunch, and that's awesome. I love
I'm
it.
I'm not Jamaican. Right. I, just, I just feel like I got a lot to do.
That's right.
The good Lord calls me.
That's right. That's right. We're supposed to be active. That's it. That's right. Active and moving and doing what we're supposed to be, what we're called to do. So that's awesome. Yeah, you have, and just as I was just reading through and just and seeing you, you have accomplished so much thus far. You have such a rich career. And I just wanted you to just take us back a little bit. What initially interests you in being an attorney in the first place?
Oh, well, I lived with my inspiration. I'm a second generation lawyer.
Okay.
My father was an outstanding criminal defense lawyer and civil rights lawyer in Illinois. He tried cases all around the state and was a NAACP president for the Will County branch of the NAACP. I watched him try a case in Southern Illinois at 8 years old, and he and I were the only people of color in that courtroom.
Wow.
And it was a criminal case, and we stayed with, quote, relatives who I'd never met before. I remember calling home and telling my mama that we were at this strange house with these people that my father kept telling me were family relatives. And I'd never met them, but they didn't have my last name. And so, you know, I would learn later that these were just a good African-American family in Southern Illinois, because there wasn't really a place for us to stay. This was in the late 60s.
Okay.
You know, Southern Illinois is below the Mason-Dixon line. And so I also remember going to court and just being amazed at my father's his rhetoric,
okay,
his skills in presenting arguments. And every day I would go to court and he'd make me sit right behind him where he was at the defense table. And he would always keep a constant eye on me because, you know, we were the only people of color in the courtroom. From the moment I heard his booming voice and the respect the judge and prosecutors gave him because of his talent and expertise, I wanted to be that guy. He was my hero. I didn't have to chase or believe in a basketball or football or baseball player or an athlete or an entertainer. My father was my hero. And he continues to be my hero. I talk to him every day. He's my best legal advisor, and he's my best life advisor, right there below the good Lord. And so I am truly blessed, having prepared to be a lawyer and having gone to Morehouse College and been trained by some of the best law professors at Howard University School of Law. They were great lawyers who just happened to be African-American and prepared me to compete at the highest levels of big law. And while I didn't want to go to a big law firm, I certainly had the opportunity later on, 3 or 4 years out of law school, and I went, and I know who I am. I'm a history-making lawyer that happens to be African-American in big law, operating at the highest levels and doing justice with lots of clients, but also a lot of community service and a lot of pro bono service. One of the ideas of going to a big firm is not forgetting about my community, not forgetting about where I grew up and who I am and who my mama and daddy are. And from Morehouse to Howard, training in public service and giving back, whether it's dollars or my time, whether it's having multi or diverse business vendors for the D.C. office of Reed Smith, being very successful and generating revenue and making a decent amount of money selling legal services has nothing to do with my obligation to give back, and I live that every day. Lastly, my mother used to tell me all the time before the good Lord took her at the ripe age of 57 or the young age of 57,
right,
she used to say that no matter how successful you are out here, baby boy, and I know you're going places, you're going to do special things in this world, and you're far more ambitious than me or your father or your brother and sister. But one, when you get there, you better act like you belong there versus you're just glad to be there.
Mm.
And two, no matter how much money you make, you're only living 50% of your life if you're not giving back to your community and making this a better place than when you found it and before you go on to your next life. And so
wow.
I live by those words, and I think about excellence every day. And whether you're incarcerated, whether you are a returning citizen, or whether you're A. Scott Bolden, you got to wake up every morning thinking about the Lord and thinking about excellence and what his plan is for you. Whether he tells you or not, or whether you can understand, appreciate, or hear it, you have to always be asking that question, because great things are in all of us. And if we miss that opportunity and those blessings to share with the rest of the world, then we have failed at least in part of our mission as being God's children.
Mm-hmm. That is so right. We're gonna add preacher to your...
No, that's a Baptist
voice. That's right.
teaching, you know what I mean?
That's right. It's good. It's good stuff.
That's right.
That's right. Right. So, that, yes.
You know, whether it's Benny Mays or Martin Luther King Jr., you know,
the truth is the truth.
President at Morehouse.
That's right.
And he used to always say, he was a great educator, and he used to always say that you're not here at Morehouse to get a college degree. You presume to get that, but you're here to change the world, and no other place on earth.
Wow.
Are there 2,000 young black men striving for excellence and being taught to be excellent Morehouse men? No place on earth other than right here in Atlanta, Georgia. And that makes Morehouse a very special place. And I've lived up to those expectations and the demands. My mentors and my father, I've lived up to them. I've grown to that crown, or tried to at least, because the crown is over my head and over all of our heads, is always moving up. So we're striving to raise our level of commitment and excellence to fill that crown. And that's all Morehouse and Howard Law School.
That's good. It's beautiful. And we need that. We need that in our communities. And I thank you for being an example and a model of that. You know, you mentioned about, yes, you're welcome, about returning citizens. And I just want to talk a little bit about your role as when you're a prosecutor. You know, what was that like? And, you know, what did you consider some of the, you know, challenging hurdles you had to deal with in that role?
Well, I was an activist prosecutor. I mean, I was right out of law school. I was in the Manhattan DA's office. I saw that the racial makeup of the executives at the DA's office in Manhattan were majority white people, and majority of people who were coming through the system were black or brown people. The racial dichotomy was always a bothersome issue, and so I did my best to change it, to push for diversity by the executive committee members and those making the decisions, the policy makers. And, you know, it really, even at a young age, it was, you know, for me, it just seemed like the right thing to do and to raise it. And it didn't make me very popular all the time, but I was trained well at the DA's office in Manhattan. And I am forever grateful for that training, because it's made me the foundation of the lawyer I am. So it was tough going to court every day and prosecuting people charged with crimes. I never was comfortable with what felt like the warehousing of people of color, of men and women. And, you know, I had certain rules that were just my rules, not the DA rules. That was, if you had a drug problem and you were charged repeatedly with possession of drugs, I would give you a program to get into a program 10 times, 15 times. It didn't matter, because it was a health issue for me. It wasn't a criminal issue.
Hmm.
Most recently, our Republican friends have figured out that drug addiction is no longer a criminal issue. It's a health issue, because the majority of people who don't look like me in this country now are involved or are subject to the opioid crisis. So that was bothersome. The racial dichotomy was bothersome. If you sold drugs, though, and if you sold drugs near school, or if you sold drugs to young kids, and those were the allegations against you, I didn't send you to a program. I sent you, hopefully, for you to think a long time about what you were doing and doing to our communities.
Hmm.
And so while I was not unfair, I was just. And if you had a record of doing this, then, you know, my recommendation was to be sentenced. And I had no regrets about that, because there are some of us in our community that all you can do is send them away. But I would always wonder whether I was punishing them or whether they were getting rehabilitated in prison. Most of the time, I would tell myself that they could take advantage of rehabilitation efforts, but few either did, or even fewer even offered that opportunity. But that being said, you know, I had mixed feelings about all of it. I knew I wasn't going to be a prosecutor forever, that I was in training to do defense work. And so I'm grateful for that training. But it was really eye-opening to be in New York and to be part of the criminal justice system, to see its flaws and to see it work. Sometimes I'm proud of the work we did in rehabilitating, or I did with my team, in rehabilitating those who were addicted to drugs, and this was during the crack epidemic. So, you know, really awful situation in New York and other major urban centers. So
Well, I know that you have, you've seen so many stories, so many returning citizens, you know, just people in community overall. But I wanted you to, just from your perspective, share either one or two stories of returning citizens that you've seen have some really tough obstacles and that they've overcome them, you know, that you just, you know, you've seen them positively turn their life around.
Well, returning citizens hits home with me. My brother's a returning citizen, and, you know, the biggest challenge for me with my brother or others who I employ or have employed or worked with through various volunteer programs and community service programs is getting them to change their mindset.
Right.
And my brother's been in and out of jail. He's a former gang member, gang leader, gang enforcer. His daddy's a judge. His brother's a lawyer. His sister's a gifted writer. And I often say that he chose that life. He didn't have to. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I'll leave that for the sociologist. But changing their mindset so that the prison mentality does not live with them outside of prison. And it's tough if you've been in and out of the system. And if you're not given an opportunity to right your life, then you're most likely to go back to living a life or a criminal life because either you've got to eat or provide for your family or it's all you know and there are no other opportunities out there. There's still a stigma associated with returning citizens, and at the root of it is lack of trust. And somehow we got to figure out how we get society past that notion of lack of trust.
Right.
It's a two-way street. Our returning citizens have to present themselves and have to talk and present and live this righteous life and show the world that you've paid your dues, you're moving on, and you're ready to live a productive, be a productive citizen outside of the walls of the penitentiary. It's tough, though, because we always talk about rehabilitation, and we talk about I've paid my dues to society, I've got a clean slate, and I'm going to move forward and live the American dream. That's more than a notion, and it may even be a fantasy in real life. I've seen my brother struggle with it. But I've also seen people that we have employed in the government as well as in the private sector not only struggle with the stigma. On one hand, those who hire returning citizens have to invest and allow themselves to trust them that they do have a clean slate. On the other hand, our returning citizens have to present and make sure they're living a righteous life so that there would be no doubt about it, that they are not going back and they're going forward. It's a really tough equation and a tough balance, but one that's really got to be made. And until both sides work well at it, and I've seen it work well in some instances, but then there are so many other community challenges that returning citizens have, let alone just black people,
right,
or brown people who are poor, disenfranchised. The poverty of our minds is what holds us back. It's not the external poverty we may live through or walk through in our communities. That certainly doesn't help. Because you live in a challenged community doesn't mean you have to suffer from poverty of the mind.
That's so true.
And that's a challenge all of us have to face on top of racism and poor educational opportunities, the lack of entrepreneurship training in our communities. You know, it's a litany of socioeconomic issues. I can't solve them or tackle them right now in this conversation, but know that even if you're not a returning citizen, these are challenges in our communities. And so when you have a record and you're returning, those challenges just double. They just do. And so I hope we continue to work hard, and you and your organization and others, to make this a better place for returning citizens. But part of it is educating those who are not returning citizens to practice fairness as they review and look at our returning citizens, who are U.S. citizens, quite frankly.
Exactly.
So we got a lot of challenges and a lot of work ahead of us.
Right. But as we do it with excellence, we know that it can be done. And it is so much about the mindset. It's so true on both sides. It really is.
Yeah.
Lastly, I want to know, you know, why you agreed to do this podcast. You're extremely busy. You've got a lot going on, but I would just love to have our audience hear why you decided that you wanted to spend some time with me tonight.
Well, we all need your voice. You need your voice. And I thank you for hosting this podcast and your commitment to a subject that is not difficult to advocate for returning citizens. People still look at returning citizens as criminals. And while they may or may not have committed crimes and they're returning citizens, the more voices of reason, the more voices of advocacy will help that part of our community. Some of our communities have a lot of returning citizens. Others don't have as many. But every community, black, white, yellow, brown, has returning citizens. And so I don't mind lending my story and my voice and my excellence and my goals and objectives and my life story to your podcast and other advocates who are out here trying to solve this riddle and convincing others, whether they're believers or not, that this is a resolvable problem, but it's up to us. So if there's someone out there listening, if there's a returning citizen listening, or if you had your family and you have a returning citizen, I hope you listen to this podcast. I hope it makes you think about what you're doing, if anything, or what you should be doing to advocate for this issue and to join forces and say enough is enough. And so if I can lend my voice, my mind, my support to it, then hopefully it makes this podcast and this movement much stronger. So
that's beautiful. Yes,
that's why I chose to spend a few minutes with you this evening.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you greatly, and I fully agree that we're working together, and it is going. We are making a difference, one
Absolutely.
Person at a time. One organization at a time, one community at a time, and so.
Well, I appreciate you, and I appreciate you having me on tonight.
All right. Well, you have a great night, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye-bye now. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Hey, you human. Coach Nate here with today's battle plan. Today, I want to talk to you a little bit about finite and infinite as it relates to disappointment and hope. It was Martin Luther King Jr. that said, "We must accept finite disappointment, but we must never lose infinite hope." For starters, finite means it has limits, boundaries. Infinite being just the opposite, immeasurable, limitless, unlimited. If we look at the word disappointment, there are actually two types, the preventable and the unpreventable. Somebody gives you their word, they commit to doing something, they make a promise or agree, and they fail to do so. It's not outside of our control. That's an unpreventable disappointment. The other types of disappointment are disappointments from expectations that we set. That's highly controllable. We set expectations on things, but who said it was going to work out that way or happen that way or play out or become what our expectations are? So we have much more control over that. Finite disappointment meaning that it's going to happen, it's going to occur, but there's a limit, there's a boundary to it. I believe it was Maya Angelou that said, every storm eventually runs out of rain. Once we know, embrace, and understand that it doesn't go on forever, the disappointment's going to come and go, perhaps rise and set like the sun, like a storm that will pass, whether it be an afternoon storm or for a week. But there's a limit to that. Embrace that and move on. And one of the ways to counter that is with infinite hope, limitless, boundaryless, indefinitely. Hope being defined as, yes, a feeling, but also an expectation of that feeling. There is a mental advantage to having hope. And the combination of, yes, that feeling and the expectation of that feeling, because that's our focus, a belief, whether your hope be based on faith, the efforts that you've put forth, the energy that you've expended, the time that you've used to dedicate yourself to something, or just the sheer belief that this is going to happen, enacts, puts in motion a set of events that can bring that into existence. Caveat there being, if it's going to benefit someone, others, preferably someone other than yourself. Yes, we can endure disappointment and we can sit and waddle and complain and regurgitate and focus on and talk about. We can actually make finite disappointment infinite by putting energy into it and focusing on it and continuing to bring it up and talk about it. That's backwards. Disappointment's going to happen. It doesn't last forever. When it occurs, we embrace it and we move on. If it's a disappointment from our own thoughts, creations, then we learn to try to avoid doing that again. In any regard, it has a limit, we move on. And we combat that with infinite hope. Hope that I don't care how bad it looks, how challenging, how insurmountable, how devastating, I'm going to have hope that it's possible. There's a way, that there may be another alternative, that there's something better, that even in something bad and devastating, something good can be found in it. You will find hope when you look for it. You will find disappointment when you look for it. The difference there being is we can continue to increase the amount of disappointment, even though it's finite, by our focus. But we will never find the end of the road of hope. Infinite, boundaryless, limitless. Which train would you rather be on? Which journey would you rather, an experience would you rather have? One that's limited, ending in disappointment, or one that's limitless, giving you a sense of positive hope that it can be better, that the sun will rise, that the rain will stop and the flowers will grow, that tomorrow will be a better day. Having said all that, it's our choice. You are empowered to make that decision. You are empowered to choose limited and boundaries or unlimited with no boundaries. What choice are you going to make for your life in the obstacles that you face, in the challenges that you're going through? Are you going to let it die off in the field of disappointment, or are you going to plant bountiful seeds of hope? Choose wisely. Until next time. This is Coach Nate. Live your best life on purpose now.
A number of times people have asked me, do you want to get involved in politics? I quickly answer, no, that's not for me. Then I started thinking about all the people that feel that way. I don't know if it's fear or lack of knowledge or just an us versus them mentality. That work of politics are for politicians. But listen to the definition of politics. The activities associated with the governance of a country or other area, especially the debate or conflict among individuals or parties having or hoping to achieve power. There are two phrases here that stand out for me. Governance of a country and hoping to achieve power. I'm not going to get into a big debate about the word power, but let's just say for the purposes of this talk, we want to use it for good. If we desire to see change in this country for returning citizens or any other problem, we have to believe that we have power. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Let no man pull you so low as to hate him." There comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but he must take it because his conscience tells him it is right. The work Mr. Bolden does, the role I play, and what you do as a part of this collective effort puts us in the position to do what is right, whether politics, popularity, or conscience. We are mobilized as a powerful source of hope and good for those unable to will this change for themselves. Walk a month workshops, sponsor a podcast, or increase your giving to our nonprofit. See opportunities on missiontomobilization.com and get today's battle plan on natebattle.com. I'm Sheila Murphy, and this is Mission Possible. We are helping change the way the nation sees returning citizens. Until next time,
create your battle plan
and make your mission possible.